Good morning. Before you start, counsel, I'm Judge Mormon. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Scholin. We're here today in the matter of Robert J. Ingram versus R. James Nicholson, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 032196. Now would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record.
Artie Michelson representing the appellant Robert Ingram.
Jeffrey Shuler representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
All right, thank you. Before we go any further, let me just give you a warning that today we are experimenting, hopefully it's more than an experiment, with a new sound system and recording system in the court. I'm told that each microphone is extremely sensitive. They don't require us to turn microphones off and on, but as with all new things, I think we can anticipate that it may not work precisely as advertised. So I'll just warn counsel in advance that if we have some technical difficulty during argument, we may call a halt to the proceedings and fix whatever problem there is. Hopefully we'll have none. Counsel for the appellant, Mr. Michelson, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor.
5 minutes? Very good. Are you ready to start?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ari Michelson, and I'm here today representing the appellant, Robert Ingram. As the court knows, Robert Ingram was a sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, received a good conduct medal. In the mid-1980s, he had an experience that changed his life dramatically. His right lung was removed, and such begins our story. I'd like to, just by way of introduction, make a couple of points. One, as the court knows, 38 CFR 3.151 makes absolutely clear that a claim by a veteran for pension may be considered to be a claim for compensation, and the greater benefit will be awarded unless the claimant specifically elects the lesser benefit. We also know in the Norris case and the Roberson case, which are certainly highlighted in this appeal, both the Federal Circuit and this court have made clear that a claim must be developed to its optimum, including all potential claims raised by the evidence. We also know that there's a general duty to assist veterans by congressional mandate. We know, for example, in the Karnas case that most favorable law applies, and basically the law is on the veteran's side. So why are we here today? There are basically two issues. One is whether or not there was a claim for compensation in Mr. Ingram's initial pleading, and given the fact that there is such an incredible amount of law on the side of the veteran to interpret the pleading as broadly as possible, it's certainly reasonable to interpret the pleading as constituting one for compensation, though I will address that further in a little bit. But the other thing is we also know from the record that, as it turns out, the board itself recognized that Mr. Ingram's injury was, in fact, exacerbated by the actions of the Veterans Administration Hospital during the course of his surgery. And in fact, both the medical examiner appointed by the board and the board itself had previously concluded, and I can quote, his postoperative course would indicate that the empemia developed within weeks of the pneumonectomy, his leak that ultimately gave him trouble throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, was clear from the medical records, as this court observed and as the medical examiner observed, within a short time after the surgery. So there was clearly a link. And ultimately, the board concluded that it seems evident from review of the claims folder that the patient has incurred additional disability that was related to the pneumonectomy. So we have facts here where we're going to need to be as reasonable as we can in interpreting the pleading. We have a clear record that the medical circumstances were such that an exacerbation did occur as a result of the surgery. And the only thing that's really keeping us from going further with this, and the reason why the court has called for this oral argument, is whether or not this claim for compensation remains as a pending claim that is unadjudicated. or whether the Andrews case in particular and its progeny require that a Q procedure be used instead. I'd like to argue today that, first, the facts of the record make clear that there is a claim for compensation, and second, that the Andrews case does not preclude this court from allowing the claim to be considered an unadjudicated pending claim. As this court is well aware, the Norris case was a case in which the court had concluded that there was an unadjudicated pending claim, and therefore a Q claim was actually inappropriate. And the Federal Circuit in the Roberson case specifically mentioned Norris and actually relied upon Norris in its analysis and considered the Norris case to be, quote, both on point and informative. And so there is at least an implicit, if not an explicit, acknowledgement by the Federal Circuit that the circumstances of the Norris case were in fact reasonable circumstances and are certainly representative of correct jurisprudence on the part of this court. The fact that the Roberson case was one in which a Q claim was brought and the Andrews case likewise was one in which a Q claim was brought, arguably the attorney bringing those Q claims should not have pled it as a Q claim. He should have brought it as an unadjudicated pending claim. The problem is that he did bring it as a Q claim, and ultimately perhaps to allow a bit of an end run around the fee or the time perhaps perhaps the Federal Circuit allowed him to be considered a final bat jurisdiction. And I would
counsel, excuse me. How do you then deal with the language that talks about the plea claim adjudicated the error instead properly for Q motion?
There are a couple of ways that, and I think the jury would agree with this. The Federal Circuit has essentially understand this jurisprudence. And the fact statement was not in any way necessary for the disposition of the case. The case, to the extent that it was decided on the basis of the Q claim being not specific enough, really was a much narrower issue than the broad statement that it made. And to the extent that the broad statement was not necessary for the decision of the court, it might be considered to be dicta. That's one thing. Another thing is that the Q claim, one way to think about it perhaps, is whether or not the claim existed may be essentially a final decision in the sense that there was supposed to be a TDIU claim that was not recognized by the board, and the failure to recognize that claim, in a sense, was a final decision of the board. It failed to recognize that, and so it was proper to bring Q to say that there was an error there, but would still ultimately have required a remand, presumably, to determine the particular benefits that were due.
If one goes with your second analysis of this could potentially be a final decision that there was no TDIU claim in the other case, would that also apply in your case that there's no that there was a final decision in 1986 that there was no 1151 claim filed?
No, Your Honor. To the extent there was a final decision on that matter, it was based on the 1992 application that requested that the 1986 application be considered to contain a compensation claim. There was no indication whatsoever back in 1986 that the RO or the board ever considered the application to be one for compensation. The only mention made is of pension. And so to the extent that this court is going to affirm or reverse the board's decision, the decision that's being reversed or affirmed would be the decision based on the 1992 application, which references the 1996.
Right. Well, my question is not that it denied an 1151 claim, but that it denied the existence of a claim.
It did not appear to deny or acknowledge one way or the other. All it did was decide that there was no pension that was due to the claimant. There simply was no decision at that time. The fact is that the law is somewhat confusing, perhaps for people who aren't practicing this every day, myself included. The fact is that there is a long history of unadjudicated pending claims existing, being recognized by this court, And it, I think, is possible to reconcile the cases and to give meaning to them while at the same time allowing unadjudicated planning claims to exist by saying that the queue procedure is an alternative to the unadjudicated claim procedure. And while the Federal Circuit itself has cautioned against ruling on decisions that are not final, there perhaps is a bit of an end run around this in the Andrews case. As I mentioned, perhaps to give just a little bit of a break to the veteran in terms of having to go all the way through proceedings again rather than to get a decision on whether or not there was a claim to begin with when it actually appeared before the court. Unfortunately, the attorneys, as I mentioned, seem to have not understood the procedure themselves when they went into the Roberson and Andrews case. And we wouldn't be here today but for their error, I would say.
Counsel, along those lines, are you familiar with the Bingham decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that fit into this scheme under your impression or reading of it?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's possible to understand Bingham as not really being directly on point because there was really only one claim. It was a claim for service connection. And there were different theories about how that service connection happened. But there was only really one claim. And it was really on the basis of the fact that since the claim itself had been finally resolved, there was a final decision there. Okay, so it's really not contradicting and, in fact, doesn't really even reiterate so much the Andrews-Roberson problem, per se.
With regard to TDIU claims, let me get your perspective relative to possibly TDIU as merely an enhancement of a basic entitlement or an award, and somehow that makes it different. Could you expound on that just a little bit for me, please?
Well, yes, Your Honor, it is a different claim because unlike a claim where you have different theories of service connection, but ultimately the way in which you'd approach the remedy would presumably be similar. With a TDIU claim, you've got a complete package of remedies available that aren't available if you don't bring a TDIU claim. And in that sense, at least, the TDIU claim would be separate from a claim that only led to 10% or 30% or something like that service connection.
But isn't TDIU simply another way of looking at the rating? And what factors go into determining what the final rating is?
Well, the fact is, Your Honor, that the law with respect to TDIU, to the extent I can expound on it, actually allows bringing a TDIU claim under circumstances where, you know, factors A, B, and C are met. Then you may automatically, for example, get a TDIU claim available to you. And in fact, one of the cases that is in the briefs, I'm sorry, I don't have the tip of my tongue, found that there was a TDIU claim for that very reason, because essentially it was mandated by statute. The fact that the law treats the TDIU claim singularly, separately from other kinds of claims, I think would allow, from a jurisprudential standpoint, enough of a logical divide between a TDIU claim and other claims to allow consistency, essentially, in interpreting the cases and allow an interpretation of Bingham such as the one that I just offered.
I'd like to turn a little bit to the factual question here about whether a claim was raised or not. Can you talk to me a little bit about what is the significance of the board's determination or the regional office's determination that the 1992 claim was for both pension and 1151, while the 1986 claim was for pension only?
Well, Your Honor, the 1992 application obviously was a lot more detailed. It contained an affidavit. There was a much more explicit discussion of an 1151 claim. There was counsel involved. It's a completely different ball of wax than the 1986 application, which was entirely pro se. I'd also like to point out that Mr. Ingram essentially asked for advice or got advice from the VA when he sent in his 1986 application, and he sent it directly to the VA hospital. And they wrote back to him and said, you shouldn't send it here, send it somewhere else, and tell us what the service connection is. As we know, an 1151 claim is treated like a service connection. Whether you consider the advice to essentially be telling the appellant to be putting down a service connection incorrectly and therefore giving wrong advice and therefore essentially not complying with the duty to assist, or whether you consider that the reference to service connection essentially tethered it to an 1151 claim. In either event, I think we should be giving the veteran the benefit of the doubt in this case.
Is there any significance to the fact that the regulations at the time of the 1986 claim required demonstration of negligence, and they did not at the later filings?
Well, the fact that the claim was never adjudicated as a compensation claim means that it was pending at the time of the Supreme Court decision that overturned that regulation and was nevertheless still filed prior to the 1997 new regulation. And therefore, the law that's applicable to this still unadjudicated pending claim is the law that the Supreme Court overturned and that does not require negligence.
Does that in any way, does the fact that this was not a requirement in 1986 in any way give credence to the VA's argument that since he didn't plead negligence, he couldn't have had the intent to plead an 1151 claim?
It would seem, Your Honor, that negligence is a term of art, and we shouldn't be requiring veterans to write the word negligence in the application in order to construe it as an 1151 claim. It's instructive in looking at especially the August 1986 in support of the claim that the veteran wrote, "I am not capable under the lifestyle." He wrote, "Under the submission, I am able to skillful trade." If this sin should have been, certainly some money might put a little bit in a different way. Likely, without esophageal leak, he was much better dead and very well may not have been able to write, not have a statement saying that he's unable to continue his normal style, that he's unable to continue in his skillful trade. Clearly, he was feeling that he was not well as a result of this surgery and not as well as he would have been had that surgery been successful. It is also clear, as I mentioned earlier, the medical examiner appointed by the board and the board recognized that within weeks of his surgery, he already was experiencing this esophageal leak. And if you look at the medical record from the April 1985 hospital admission when the lung was actually removed, which was actually part and parcel, or should be considered part and parcel of the application, it says several chest x-rays were obtained which showed his right pleural space to gradually fill with fluid. Now, that doesn't explicitly say that there was a problem, but it seems to be a harbinger of things to come. The medical record throughout this case shows that within weeks of the surgery, he was never well again. He was never the same again. And by the time he filed this application, somewhat about a year after the surgery, he was really not doing well. And in fact, a couple of months after that, he was admitted again. And the medical records from that October 1986 hospital admission indicate that already 2 or 3 months prior to that time he was not well, and that certainly encompasses the time period during which he filed this August 1986 statement.
Now, those records didn't become a part of this record until after the 91 filing, as I 92 filing.
Well, certainly the October 86 didn't, because the decision, the RO decision, was in August of 86. That's correct. But the 85 medical record was still available. And had the RO actually entertained a compensation claim, of course, there could have been a whole evidentiary hearing and accumulation of evidence and medical reports the way it actually happened later on.
Is there anything to be gleaned from the fact that he never appealed this decision in 1986?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because there was no decision on the claim for him to appeal. The only thing he could have appealed was the decision on the pension. So the fact that he didn't appeal a compensation claim, there was no decision to appeal. The Federal Circuit jurisprudence, and I will actually perhaps stop a little bit early and reserve a couple more minutes of my time if I can. I just think that it's important to note that the Federal Circuit's own jurisprudence indicates that an earlier decision of the court takes precedence over a later decision unless overruled en banc. Now, certainly the Norris decision was not a Federal Circuit decision, and the Roberson decision acknowledged the Norris decision, and so it wasn't exactly explicitly a Federal Circuit decision. But arguably, there is something there in terms of the Federal Circuit itself having earlier recognized the still viable unadjudicated pending claim in a decision that issued prior to the Andrews decision, and therefore arguably could be considered to trump the jurisprudence that might otherwise be attributed to the Andrews decision. I don't think, however, it's necessary to hold Andrews to absolutely requiring a Q claim as the procedural mechanism. It just simply offers an alternative, and the court has traditionally been sensitive to the plight of veterans, and I don't think that the Federal Circuit intentionally would have foreclosed a procedure that was long-standing and that, in fact, does offer certain advantages over the Q procedure, notwithstanding the fact that allowing a final decision on Q at the Federal Circuit may circumvent some procedural steps. Nevertheless, from an evidentiary standpoint, for example, and for other reasons, the Q mechanism is a collateral attack. It's not as good a mechanism as the unadjudicated pending claim. It would seem difficult to believe that the court intentionally foreclosed a better avenue for veterans in view of congressional intent and the entire scheme of veterans law to do everything we can to help veterans and do things for their benefit.
Well, counsel, as you may recall, there was some relatively pointed language in that decision directed toward this court in terms of repetition of basic principles that the circuit felt need to be expounded upon. I think one could read that and say they, at least that panel wasn't confused as to where they wanted to go with this jurisprudence. So, what do we do with the Andrews decision, in your opinion?
Well, Your Honor, what we would urge this court to do would be to interpret Andrews in light, for example, of the what appears to be this court's willingness to work with Andrews in the Beverly decision, leaving it open as an alternative, but still allowing and, in fact, if not favoring, the unadjudicated pending claim as the mechanism. That would be what we would urge this court to do, and the ultimate result would be a remand because the claim has not been finally adjudicated. It would be necessary to go back and determine how much would be due the veteran and so on and so forth. In the alternative, I suppose, if this court felt that its hands were tied by the Federal Circuit, we would try to argue it before that court, but it would seem that if this court builds on the Bingham decision and develops its jurisprudence as showing that there is a viable alternative, that would provide the benefits to the veterans while still giving effect, essentially, to the Federal Circuit by allowing the Q mechanism without undermining something that's longstanding. And if the court later wants to comment further, I suppose it would do so. It would be detrimental to my client to urge that this court take a hard line on Andrews and say, oh yes, the Federal Circuit definitely said you can't possibly use unadjudicated claims. Of course, this is court's prerogative if it wants to phrase it that way in order to get clarification from the court, but I would urge this court not to do so, but instead to follow what it has done with the Beverly case and to continue in that along those lines and offer it as an alternative.
Counsel, let me ask you this. With regard to the logical extension of the argument you make with regard to the 86 filings in this case, would that indicate to you that VA has an obligation to treat any claim that raises an implication of VA medical treatment, with or without an untoward outcome, to look at such a claim to determine whether or not there's an 1151 claim implicated and do development accordingly?
That's a reasonable question, Your Honor. I think under these circumstances, there is objectively in the record, in the application itself and the associated medical records, words that would seem to go beyond simply saying there was surgery. To be fair, since a claim for pension doesn't require that you mention any particular reason why you're disabled, for example, is purely based on the fact that you have disability, if you wrote nothing, then indeed it probably should only be construed as a pension claim. But if you did write that there was a medical procedure and that you're not feeling well, then arguably at least the compensation claim should be adjudicated. Now, there may not be evidence in the record to warrant an award of compensation, but why foreclose the possibility of that to the veteran when it really would only take a bit of inquiry on the part of the court to determine whether the evidentiary basis for the claim exists, without just foreclosing it altogether and saying, no, there's no claim to begin with. It would seem to be harsh to the veteran to do that. If there's nothing further, Your Honors, I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Counsel for VA.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Jeffrey Chisholm, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. To my counsel is Mary Ann Flynn, Principal Assistant General Counsel for the Department of Veterans Affairs. The Secretary asked this Court to record December 12, 2003, a decision that affected April 15, 1992, for grant of pension compensation benefits. In the decision, the Board reviewed the relevant law and regulations concerning the dates. They considered the 1986 application and they constituted a claim for pension, but did not constitute a claim for sexual cessation benefits.
Does 3.151 apply to 1151 claims?
That it does. I think that you're that the Secretary said a claim for pension to be one for compensation for pension and compensation includes Section 1151 benefits, and I think the Secretary believes that it does. In this case, as we look at these two documents that were submitted by the appellant, as well as the evidence in record at the time, which is constituted simply the April 1985 hospital report, surgical report, and pathology report, in aggregate did not indicate a claim. On the application, for example, the appellant did not complete blocks 26 to 28, which dealt with compensation claims. He did complete blocks 33 to 39, which dealt with pension claims. In the August 1986 statement, he indicated that...
Counselor, if I could interrupt you right there, you're pointing with some significance to him not completing blocks 26 through 28, but those discuss disability and service, which was never asserted. So I fail to see the significance of your reliance on that.
I concur, Your Honor. It is the language in that instruction note clearly does indicate service-connected disability. Right. It is a piece, though, of the puzzle. And as we look at the
but documents. couldn't one argue that it's actually pointing in the direction that he was claiming an 1151 claim and not claiming a service connection claim, because he puts down in the nature of the disability or nature of sickness that he had this lung operation and that it was at a VA hospital. If he was only claiming pension, he wouldn't have needed to fill that out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. And when he noted the right pneumonectomy that he had in 1985 at the VA hospital, he simply indicated that fact. What was not indicated there was any additional disability, which was a standard of 1151 benefits, that there was anything beyond that. Now, he did indicate that he had a surgery and completed the pension section. That clearly indicated a pension claim, which the VA adjudicated. It's not clear that it also constituted a claim for additional disability under the compensation.
If it's not clear, isn't VA under some obligation to further develop that claim to make it clear?
Well, I think it needs to be seen in context with the evidence that was before the VA at the same time, which was limited to the hospital reports. and a pathology report and a surgical report, which indicated that he was discharged improving, that he was tolerated the procedure well. And there's not any indication in there, in those documents, that he had additional disability that was related directly to the actual surgery. And that's the standard, the additional disability. And that's not clear from that, from the statements and from the medical evidence. That's what VA was looking at in 1986. Contrast that with 1992, when there was a statement clearly indicating additional disability in June of 1992. There was also medical evidence submitted, a form of an affidavit from a physician, indicating some additional disability. And at the same time, resubmitted was the April 1985 medical reports from that hospitalization. So there's clearly a link there.
If it was unclear in 1986, and VA in 1986 at the time in August that they acted on the pension claim had inquired of the veteran what his current medical status was, would that change things?
It would depend entirely, I think, on any response, obviously.
And on the record that we have before us, it appears that they would have gotten a substantial set of medical records had they made that inquiry, medical records that indicated follow-on medical problems between 1985 and 1986, wouldn't they?
I think that you're right that the record certainly shows that down the line several years, he became aware that there were problems and that they were linked to that 1985 surgery. It's not clear that at that time, though, he recognized that. And the intent to file is what's at issue here. Was he intending to file a compensation claim? At the time, it's not clear from the record because of the time that he had treatment later that started identifying issues in the esophageal leak, that would have been aware to him at the time. Now, it did come into evidence later, and VA did adjudicate the compensation claim and eventually award him based on development conducted through the board's procedures that they use in their adjudication. But it's not clear at the time that he would have been able to come back with evidence indicating there's additional disability. In 1986, he wouldn't have been able to come back with that type of information.
One of the justifications for finding that has been that he didn't articulate that there was any fault or negligence. Can you talk to me a little bit about the basis for that pleading requirement?
The regulation at the time required a fault, a negligence standard, which was obviously the issue in Brown v. Gardner. Even if we have an error or a discrepancy in the assessment of what he needed to say, what he didn't say was the additional disability, or an identification of additional disability, which is the standard in the statute that was at issue in Brown v. Gardner.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to analogize to another, perhaps, service connection claim for aggravation, which you'd also have to then articulate or prove a difference or an increase in a disability. I don't think that the court or statute has ever required in the application to show the difference in disability, am I correct?
I think I would concur with the assessment that you need not plead specific language and plead
in the application.
In the application, that he needs specific language indicating I have additional disability using those
language.
Is
that contrary to the position that the board and the secretary has taken in his brief?
No, I don't think so. I think they did indicate that he didn't discuss, in their phrasing, in their use of the terms negligence, fault standard. But it is one piece of that puzzle. And I think even taking that piece out and looking at the evidence that was there, the statements, and did that in aggregate, just that, indicate additional disability? And I don't see that as showing that additional disability.
Counsel, is it your position then that Andrews requires Mr. Ingram to assert Q in the 86 RO decision?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Earlier in his argument, Mr. Michelson made some reference to Andrews and said he thought possibly Secretary's counsel would agree with his assessment. Do you recall that statement?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Was he correct and accurate in making that representation?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary maintains that if there is a claim, and we do not argue that there is a claim, but if the court were to conclude that there is a claim, Andrews holds. We assessed in our supplemental brief kind of a broad range of different factors that Andrews implicates because it is a very broad holding. But its holding is so broad, we clearly held, they said, and there's no qualifying statements there. It's explicitly rejected the pending claim argument presented by the government in that case. It was also noted in Johnston that it was the same argument was being rejected in Johnston. So it's not just Andrews, but also Johnston that is rejecting the pending claim argument. And in Bingham, Andrews is compared favorably. And so you have, an indication within the Federal Circuit that they clearly want to have Q as the remedy.
Does it make any difference, the fact that what the Andrews court and the Bingham court had before them was in the context of a Q claim, as opposed to opining on a direct appeal such as this?
I don't think that there is a distinction because mm-hmm. of the breadth of the language, and because in Bingham they applied it in a compensation claim, or they compared it favorably in a claim involving service connection for hearing loss in that case. So you have.
But it was already finally decided and then brought later as a Q, as opposed to in this case, Mr. Ingram, with his current appeal, died some final back file a Q claim. Is there your reading of Andrew, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Now, Mr. Ingram be disadvantaged if he under a new.
I think he would, in terms of standards applicable here, obviously the pending claim standard is less burdensome than it, almost by definition.
Well, also in light of the change in the law subsequent to Gardner. Because under a Q claim, would he be judged as it existed
at the time? Yes, Your Honor. It would be more. That would add in and a curve that he would have to plead over. So, yes, I concur that there is clearly a higher burden that he would have to reach.
Or I guess an argument could also be made that it would be pending but found under Q, so he'd apply current. We'll get to that.
If I may, Your Honors, the difficulty in applying Andrews in this case, though, is the fact that before the agency, the appellant didn't argue Q. He argued effective date. And appellant before this court, in his opening brief and his supplemental brief, never advanced a Q argument indicating that there was clear and unmistakable error in VA's alleged failure to recognize a 1986 claim. He's essentially abandoned any challenge here to the 1986 adjudication without as being clear and unmistakable error. So the remedy in that case, if Andrews applies, the remedy in that case seems to be dismissal in the line of Simmons v. Principi, which discusses a dismissal of a Q claim for lack of or without prejudice to the appellant's refiling before the agency. And Johnston applies a similar remedy. So if we have a claim in this case, and if Andrews applies, and the remedy is Q as against the unadjudicated claim, we have no argument here in appellant's opening and supplemental brief to indicate, and that indicates dismissal of the appeal at this level.
I take it that your argument then incorporates the notion that Norris has been overruled.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. When Roberson discussed Norris, it did discuss it as analogous, it's instructive, but then in the next paragraph it distinguishes it, and it distinguishes it based upon an original claim versus a later claim after service connection is granted and a later claim for rating. In this case, what we have is a original claim. The May 1986 application is the original claim. And there's an analogy between how Andrews treated this issue and its distinguishment of Norris. And so that's another indication that the Federal Circuit intended that the federal pending claim doctrine is set aside, that Q is the remedy against the lack of adjudication.
In this case, going back to examining whether or not there's a pending unadjudicated claim here, when we look at the filings in 92, and after the board's decision in 99, the case went back to the RO, and the RO initially awarded an effective date, and then in 2002, I believe, came back and said there was a clear and unmistakable error in our prior decision, and we have an earlier effective date, and gave it the effective date of the filing of the claim form. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, can you tell me what the significant differences are between the claim form that was filed at that time and the claim form that was filed in 1986?
The significant differences are, we alluded earlier, the completion of the blocks dealing with compensation, admittedly not for necessarily for 1151 benefits, but for compensation benefits, and the completion of the pension block. Those are blocks 33 to 39. In 1986, very specifically completed those. The 1992 application, he did the reverse. He completed the compensation section, but did not complete the pension section. In addition, we have to see this. This course jurisprudence discusses seeing a claim within the context of the evidence that's presented with it. In 1986, we had April 1985 hospital surgical pathology reports. 1992, we had those, but we
Counsel,
also had...
Counsel, let's go back to what you just told me, and if you would, take a look at the forms that were filed. They're at 23 in the record and 50 in the record, I think.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, explain to me again, if you would, please, the difference in how the veteran treated this claim form on the two different occasions?
If, Your Honor, at record 24,
okay,
toward the bottom,
mm-hmm,
it indicates nature and history of disabilities. Block 24 is nature of sickness and disease. He writes 1985, right lung removed.
Okay.
Just a little bit below there is a note. Items 26, 27, and 28 need not be completed unless you are now claiming compensation for disability incurred in service. Your Honor, we turn to record 25. About three quarters of the way down is another note, just under the net worth of veterans and dependents. There's another note, items 33A through 33E should be completed only if applying for service-connected pension. And he completes that block there. He does not complete the compensation section. He does indicate the right lung removal in the VA medical facility where that was accomplished. If we turn to record site 51, excuse me, 52.
Well, let's look at 51 first. He doesn't complete anything on block 26, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Unless NA constitutes completion.
No, Your Honor. But he does, the next page, 27, discuss specific treatment in 1985, 1986, and 1987, mm-hmm, specific positions where he received that treatment. Below, about three quarters of the way down, items 33 through 33D should be completed only if you're applying for non-service connected pension. At that point, he does not complete. He writes NA there. And on page 53, he continues to write NA all the way through.
Well, back there in 86, he put none in a lot of those blocks, didn't he?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
And zeros.
I think the significant difference is that he's identifying treatment after the 1985 surgery,
Well, when he filed the claim in 86, how much additional treatment had he completed?
Well, none at that time, and which goes to my point of what he knew at the time.
So he identified.
So would your answer be different if there, he had completed substantial medical treatment by August of 86? Additional medical treatment?
I'm sorry, you're...
Are you saying that there was no substantial additional medical treatment between the time of the surgery, the original surgery, and the time that he filed his claim in 86?
It does not appear so from the record.
So he listed as much treatment as he had, which
yes,
was what he did again in 1992.
Yes,
sir. So I'm having a hard time understanding your point of how that's a lot more information. It's just he had more treatment to list.
Yes, Your Honor. And it identified to, that's one piece of the puzzle on the 1992 application. What he also submitted with that is, or 2 months after this, he submits a statement in June of 1992 discussing, indicating negligence. He identifies negligence in that treatment. That's clearly putting on notice that he's claiming additional disability with that 1985 surgery.
So you're looking beyond the four corners of the document.
Yes, and this,
which in the board decision reviewing the 1986 decision, it said looking at the four corners of the 1986 document.
Yes,
so VA would argue that you look beyond just the application to decipher intent.
Yes, Your Honor. Jurisprudence supports that in Stewart v. Brown,
okay,
and Bonner.
And were to not register for discussion purposes the way you're suggesting, then the VA, in not more broadly 1986 beyond the four corners of
the VA in the board decision, they are limiting its review to that. No, Your Honor, I don't think with a broader evidence. I don't think.
So it's more harmless error.
Harmless error. The agency has some discretion. It's not unlimited, but it does have some discretion. The regulation at issue here, 3.151A. That was in Stewart to show some discretion. It is not then required to move beyond that and prognosticate what claims are being filed. We need to be able to adjudicate what's been presented given a reasonable interpretation of what the claimant is intending to apply for. These 1986 documents, given that scope of discretion, clearly indicates the pension claim which was adjudicated and is not clear that it's indicating an intent to apply for Section 1151 compensation benefits. That intent element is very clear in 1992, and VA then took that and began adjudicating the claim, ultimately in the claimant's favor.
Counsel, do you know if Mr. Ingram had any assistance in preparing the forms in 86 and 92?
Your Honor, it appears that he did have assistance in 92, I believe, with a Veterans Service Organization representative. I don't recall specifically. I don't recall that he had help. He may have, but I can't indicate that he did have help. It looked like it was at least, it was probably pro se.
Well, if I'm reading Andrews correctly, we're supposed to provide a sympathetic reading, all of us, if the veteran is unrepresented, and not so sympathetic if he is represented. Is that your reading of Andrews
yes,
as well?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And it's consistent with this court's longstanding jurisprudence from EF onward. And I think the recent case of this court in Bonner v. Nicholson is instructive along these lines, where the Roberson liberal pleading requirement, as it was interpreted by the Federal Circuit, was applied in that case. And the court did not find a claim in that case for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The appellant had claimed cancer on the application form and submitted evidence with that application indicating Hodgkin's lymphoma. Later came back and said, no, it should include non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as well. And this court said, no, the claim was limited to Hodgkin's based on the application, but also as informed by the evidence that was submitted with it.
Well, going back to the 86 application, you know, the term code pleading jumps into my head from my civil procedure days. And you have notice pleading and you have code pleading, which is very formalistic, and filling out the correct boxes versus not the correct boxes. And then I'm trying to apply the injunction of the Andrews case in terms of sympathetic reading if the veteran is not represented or assisted versus he is represented or assisted, and trying to get back to that 86 claim. But it's your position that Q is the only avenue available to Mr. Ingram to attack that 86 decision.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Based on the factors that I outlined before and how the Federal Circuit has broadly interpreted, or its language it used in its holdings that was unqualified, its specific rejection of the pending claim argument presented by the government in that case, its favorable comparison in Bingham, by its the Roberson holding or discussion, which distinguished Norris, found no, that's not applicable. Thank you, Your Honor. The Secretary just asked the Court to affirm the Board's decision as having not filed a claim. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, if I may, in rebuttal, I'd just like to begin by looking at the Secretary's supplemental brief, which at page 4 has a headline, section head: the Federal Circuit's holding in Andrews that a claim not properly construed as having been raised is not considered unadjudicated, so on and so forth, is contrary to statutory and regulatory schemes of both Q and pending claims. So clearly the Secretary disagrees with the Andrews holding. And moreover, on page 7, first full paragraph, I'll quote, "In short, the Federal Circuit, in enunciating its holding in Andrews, although rejecting the government's contentions, did not overrule or modify this court's jurisprudence with respect to pending claims, citing several cases." Your Honors, I just, on that basis, I made the statement earlier that I thought that there was some agreement between us and the Secretary, and I was a little bit surprised, actually, by the Secretary's seeming to change positions. I'd also like to address the intent issue and ask how much is required of a pro se veteran applicant to know about the law when he fills out an application, to even understand the distinction between a pension claim and a compensation claim. Moreover, as I mentioned earlier, when he actually wrote to the VA hospital and he got some advice back, the advice didn't say to him, don't forget, you can both get a pension and compensation claim, so be sure when you fill out your application to do that. Instead, it just said, just indicate what your service connection is. And either that was incorrect advice, or it was advice that sort of indirectly seemed to indicate that there was an 1151 possibility. In terms of the intent, I think it would be dangerous to have precedent that required the veteran to understand that much about the law, especially in view of evidence that the VA itself did not advise him correctly. Last thing I'd just like to offer as a possibility, I'm not sure, the Secretary indicates that the only possible avenue is attacking the 1986 decision is Q. It would seem that the 1992 application that ultimately asked for an effective date going back to 1985 in the alternative 1986, it was through that analysis that there was error made, and it's simply in reversing the Board's decision with respect to that. It's not clear to me that that could not be considered the clear error that is necessary to reverse and then remand to the board to actually re-adjudicate based on the 1992 application asking for the effective date going back to the 1985 or 1986 application. It's not clear to me, just standing up here right now without doing any further research, if Q attack on the 1986 decision is the only avenue that remains, even if the Secretary's interpretation of Andrews that seems in contrast with the brief is correct. I'll just conclude by reiterating that I believe it is possible to consider Andrews to be an alternative. It doesn't seem, even in the Secretary's own word in the brief, to be the only avenue. The jurisprudence of unadjudicated pending claims seems to still be viable. And I think in looking at the pleading in this case, for a pro se veteran, there's plenty of evidence on the record to allow a broad reading of that. And I'd urge this court to allow that, that initial 1986 application to be read so broadly.
All right, thank you very much. The case will be submitted for consideration, and the court before adjourning will now come down and greet counsel.
It didn't broadcast. It didn't broadcast. I mean, I got it back.